This is part one of a two-part chat with Brendan Minnick about asynchronous programming in .NET. Part two will come out in a few weeks. This is a No Dama podcast. I'm Brian Hogan, and this evening I'm joined by Brendan Minnick, a developer advocate at Microsoft, and he's joining me from San Francisco. Thank you very much for taking time out of your evening, Brendan.
Hey, thanks so much for having me, Brian.
To start off, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, please?
Sure. Yeah, like you mentioned, my name's Brendan Minnick. I work at Microsoft as a developer advocate, and I specialize in Xamarin and Azure. And one of the reasons why that is I used to work at Xamarin, which is how I made it to Microsoft. Xamarin was a small startup that Microsoft acquired a couple years ago. And after joining Microsoft, I heard about the developer advocacy team, which is all about helping developers. So whether that is speaking at conferences or making videos or chatting to folks on podcasts like we're doing today, whatever way we can help developers better understand Microsoft tools, and in my specific case with Xamarin and Azure, then it's great. So I get to do a lot of fun things like this, and also there's definitely some travel involved, and that's actually how we met back at NDC Oslo a couple months ago.
How much travel is there for someone like you, or maybe you in particular, let's say?
Yeah, so it all depends on the team, and I think that's one really cool thing with our team is it's up to the individual. So me personally, I like traveling. My Twitter handle is The Code Traveler. So I tend to travel once or twice a month. And part of that is also playing into my strengths. I love speaking. I love going to conferences. I love meeting folks at meetups. But there's a lot of folks on our team who don't like traveling, but they're really good at writing blog posts, or they're really good at recording videos, or they're really good at making samples. And so, yeah, across the gamut on our team, you have folks that essentially live on planes to then folks that maybe travel a couple times a year. And it's really cool to be on a team where our managers and leaders do kind of let us play to our own strengths, because they essentially trust us that we know our community and what'll help the developers out there, and to do that in the best way we know possible.
Tonight, we're going to mainly talk about common mistakes in asynchronous programming in .NET. But before we get to that, let's fill in a little bit of background information. What is asynchronous programming first?
Yeah, that's a good question. So there is two topics that we'll definitely be distilling today, and that's asynchronous programming, and then also multi-threading or parallel programming. And asynchronous essentially means that you're going to call code that will return a value in the future. And that value that you want might not be available right away. You know, if we think back before the world of async await, if we called a method that was going to add two numbers, it would return an int, and you'd pass in two numbers, and it would just add those together, and you would get that value basically right away. I mean, we're talking some nanoseconds for the CPU to process that and add the numbers together, but for all intents and purposes, you get that result back right away. As computers took over the world and the internet happened, and now we're having to make API calls to remote servers in the cloud, when you call that method that adds two numbers, well, maybe that adding is done on a remote server in Azure, and so it's not going to be ready right away. So we have to wait for that result to come back. And with async await, it allows us to essentially run the code to say, go get it. I trust that you'll bring that result back to me in the future. And when we use the async await keyword in .NET, that basically says, I'm going to kick you off. You go do what you need to do. And then when you're done, come back and let me know. And if there's a result with it, let me know what that result is. So that's async asynchronous program or async await, multi-threading is similar, but it's also talking about doing a lot of things in parallel. So with that first example where we're calling an API, an API that is somewhere else in a remote server up in the cloud, waiting for that to come back. If we were to do that for 5 different APIs all at the same time, then we could have essentially 5 chunks of code running simultaneously. And so that's where you get into multi-threading. But then what gets even more interesting, and we don't have to go this deep today, but a CPU can only handle one thread at a time, or a CPU core, I should say. And so there's still even a limit there to what this CPU can actually process simultaneously, because if you have a 4-core CPU and you've kicked off 5 threads, well, one is still technically waiting. So yeah, it's a crazy world with async await, multi-threading, a lot of that. But the good news is a lot of that is abstracted up. So us as developers, we don't need to know about all that, or rather we don't need to build the systems around it because it just kind of works. But what's really helpful is understanding how that works, so that when something does go wrong and you can look at the code and say, oh yeah, I remember that's because the compiler does this and then that turns it into that. And I see here on this line of code, we missed this certain keyword. And it was actually all of this what inspired me to do this, to give that talk at NEC Oslo, where we met, correcting common async await mistakes, was because I had been doing async await for years, but I never really knew how it worked. I never really knew what the compiler was doing, how .NET handled all this stuff under the hood. And it wasn't until I started getting weird stack traces back. It wasn't until I started getting bad reviews in the App Store about folks saying, tapping this button and this button and this button causes the app to act weird, and trying to figure that out by looking at the code and saying, there's no way that should be possible. Like, that's not the code I wrote. It wasn't until I started digging into how does this actually work in .NET that I was able to solve those problems, and it became very apparent. And so it was basically my inspiration that I felt like if I've been doing .NET for years and I've been doing async and await and I didn't know all this stuff, how many other people out there are in the same boat? How many other people are also making the same mistakes that we can help out?
If I said to you, I've got a method that looks something like public, IEnumerable of products, get products. I mean, that's synchronous method. And I say to you, you know what? This asynchronous stuff sounds great. How do I make that asynchronous? What are the steps to take a synchronous method and make it asynchronous?
Yeah, so we'll ignore the fact that C# 8 and .NET Core 3 have just come out, and there's a new toy we get to play with called iAsync Enumerable.
Sure. Leave that one aside.
But what you would do is, instead of returning an iEnumerable of type product, what you would return is a task of type iEnumerable of type product. And we would add in the async keyword into that method. I don't know what that line is called.
Signature, the title line. Or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, method signature. So we would transform that into public async task of type iEnumerable of type product, get products. And what that essentially allows us to do is somewhere or anywhere in that method, we can now use another keyword, await. And so if that original method of get products was calling a remote API to get products, well, we can now use the await keyword. And that basically tells us, hey, we know you're going to go do it. That's fine. We're going to kick you off. You're off and running. But when you're done, come back and let me know, and then we'll resume to the next line of code. And the big benefit there is by calling that await keyword, we've freed up what's known as the calling thread. So the original thread that kicked off that method, once it hits that await keyword, it can either, if it's a background thread, it can return back to the thread pool, or maybe it's the main thread or the UI thread, and that thread can go back to interacting with and listening for user events, because the main thread is the only one that can respond to button clicks, or if the user scrolls the page, it needs to be the one to update the UI. So it's very important. Actually, I would say it's critical in apps nowadays that do have UIs to essentially offload the main thread as much as possible, make sure it's always available to listen to the user, because as soon as we lock up that main thread to our users, our app just looks frozen. And then what do? Well, they force quit the app, or they leave our website, or quit, give us a 1-star review, or leave bad reviews all over the internet, and then we're hosed just because we didn't use that await keyword.
Yeah, I think is there one other thing you would need to do as well with the await? You'd have to call the asynchronous version of the method to make that API request as well.
Yeah, good call. So we were chatting about this earlier, that there's actually a lot of libraries coming out nowadays that don't even have a non-asynchronous call for them. But yeah, there's definitely libraries out there that will have two options. One is synchronous, one is asynchronous. The asynchronous will return a task, which is how we're able to await it. So in this example, we're calling get products, and those products live on a remote server. So we would probably call something like post async, and we would be awaiting that method to get back its results.
Yeah, or another common one would be with entity framework. You would have context.products.toList. It would become await context.products.toList async.
Right. Yeah. And I just realized I said post async. It should be get async.
Sure. Another thing, though, when you have changed your method from the signature from, let's say, the public enumerable of products to the public task enumerable of products, what happens at the compiled level down, let's say, in the CLR?
Yeah, so this was the eye-opening part to me. And like I said, it was the inspiration for giving this this talk at NDC Oslo, was that when we put the async keyword onto a method, what the compiler actually does, well, it does a lot. So the first thing it does, it takes the method we wrote and it turns it into a class that inherits from an interface called iAsyncStateMachine. And that, honestly, that one's not too big of a deal. It does add some overhead. It adds about 100 bytes, not kilobytes, not megabytes, just bytes. So 100 bytes, which, you know, in 2019, that's probably not going to affect anybody. But we'll say, fun fact, your app size will increase by 100 bytes every time you use the async keyword. Which probably nowadays only affects somebody doing something on IoT where that's a constraint. But inside of that class, it generates a method called moveNext. And moveNext was always, it was the missing link for me before I knew about this, because I would get these stack traces back anytime my app would crash, and there would always be a move next method in there. And that was always really confusing to me, because I never wrote a method called move next, but like there it is in all these stack traces. And then I just learned to ignore it, because I was like, I don't know where that came from. That's not my code. I don't know how to fix that. But that exist in the stack traces because that's part of this compiler-generated class. And so if you, and then if you dive into move next, what move next is, or the code inside move next, is our code. It's the code we wrote in our async method, but it's turned into a giant switch statement. So if you can picture case 0, case 1, case 2, our code has put into this giant switch, and every time we have used the await keyword in our method, the compiler has generated a new case. So if we had used the await keyword once, then the compiler will generate a switch statement with case 0 and case 1. So two cases. If we had used the await keyword twice, then we would have three cases, so on and so forth. But basically, what's happening in that switch statement is it's executing the code we wrote up to the await keyword. And right before, right when our code hits the await keyword, it'll essentially kick off the task. So whatever task we're awaiting, it'll kick it off and then return. So if thread one had called this method and thread one runs this code in our switch statement, in our code that we wrote, thread one would hit the await keyword and then return back to, we'll say, the user in my case, because thread one's my UI thread for my mobile apps. Meanwhile, that task that we just kicked off is running on a background thread. And then it's when that thread, or when that background thread is done, when that task is completed, it will call back to the calling thread. So in this case, it calls back to thread one, and then thread one jumps back into this giant switch statement, but instead of going back to case zero, it'll go into the next case. So it'll go to case one, where it gets the result from the task that we kicked off and keeps executing some code, basically picking up where it left off. So we have our async method in our code that becomes a compiled class. That compiled class has a method called move next, which is a giant switch statement. That giant switch statement contains a new case every time we use the await keyword. And that is how we're able to essentially free up the calling thread, because that calling thread is able to return and also then come back in and pick up where it has left off. But then this next part, this is the one that I think I wish I had known about the most. It's the one that it invoked the most bugs in my code. That move next method, that giant switch statement, is all wrapped inside of a try-catch block. So even though in my async task method that I wrote, I did not use try-catch at all, when the compiler generates that class, and specifically move next, it wraps all of my code inside of a try-catch block. And so what that means is if an exception is thrown anywhere in my code, the code that I wrote for my async task method, that exception will be caught inside of move next, inside of my compiler generated code. And the good news is, if we just use the await keyword, if we've awaited that async task method, then the compiler rethrows the exception. So that exception's caught inside of move next, but is then rethrown because we awaited it. And that's something I wish I would have known, because I thought I had figured out async await, and I thought I was being clever. I was doing this thing where I would do what I called a fire and forget method, or a fire and forget task, where I would say something like task.run. I would put some code in there that I wanted to run on a background thread, but I didn't care when it finished, so I would not await that task. And what ended up burning me was sometimes that code in task.run would throw an exception. But because I didn't await the original task, that exception was just swallowed up and gone forever. And so that was how my app would get into weird states, because a result would come back from maybe a remote API that I wasn't expecting. Like maybe the mobile app doesn't have an internet connection. Well, that result that comes back isn't going to be the result I expected. It's going to be a failed result. And I want that exception. I want to know that exception happened so that I can gracefully handle it. But in actuality, in my code, that exception was swallowed up forever. I was just assuming it was good because I never saw an exception. And then all of a sudden, my app's in this weird state that the user can't get out of without force quitting and starting over. And so it was learning what the compiler does with my code that was so eye-opening, because, yeah, I was doing these fire and forget things all over my code base, and it was just causing all sorts of bad things to happen.
Yeah, I've seen things where exceptions get swallowed a lot, and I know it's something that Stephen Cleary has blogged a lot about, and it is covered in his book pretty well. Let's move on a little bit to, let's say, common scenarios or common problems people have. And one of the, I think, one of the more common ones I've come across myself, and I've seen other people having, is trying to run synchronous code over asynchronous or asynchronous code over synchronous. Can you maybe explain why they're so difficult and why you might need to do them?
Yeah. So let's start with the first scenario where we're in a method that is not async, but the method we're in needs to call a different method that does return a task that is async. So this is a scenario that's becoming more and more rare, but I still see it sometimes where I have to implement an interface, and maybe this interface requires a method that returns a bool. It doesn't return a task of type bool, it just returns bool. And so now I'm stuck implementing this interface method that returns a bool, and now I can't use async await. So great, what do we do? Well, let's say earlier we were talking about that, making an HTTP call, calling get async. In our non-async method, we can still call that get async method, but we won't be able to await it. So we have a couple options, and let's see, I'll tell you the ones I don't recommend first, and we'll save the best for last. So the first option is we can say dot result at the end. So we can call get async, or we can say get async dot result. Now, the reason I don't recommend this, and actually my rule of thumb is to never use dot result ever. I wish it didn't exist. I've actually reached out to the .NET team internally to ask them if, can we get rid of dot result? And I'll have the same rant in a minute about dot wait, but it's there. It'd be a breaking change. We can't. It'll be there forever. But anyways, so what we can do, we can call dot result. And dot result will return back the value from our get HTTP call. But the reason that dot result is bad and I don't recommend it is because it's what's called a blocking call. So in the earlier example, we had thread one kick off this method. Thread one got to the await keyword, and then that freed up thread one to go back and interact with the user. In this example, where we're using dot result instead of the await keyword, thread one now gets to that method, that get async dot result. And what dot result says, it says, thread one, you have to stay right here. I'm still going to run get async on a different thread, but until I'm done, thread one, you cannot return back to the user. You have to stay right here and wait for me to finish. And so that's dangerous for me as a mobile app developer, because we were saying earlier, thread one is what interacts with the user. So if thread one, or if the user starts to swipe on our app or tap a button or navigate to a new page, well, thread one's not there to listen or listening for it. And that also means thread one can't draw the new UI that the user's asking for, maybe by scrolling or tapping a button. And so our app is frozen. Now, not everybody works on UI apps. So what if you're making an API? Is dot result still bad? And the answer is still yes, because thread one is locked. Meanwhile, a background thread's running, let's say thread two. It could be any thread, thread 10, thread 20, but we'll just say thread two is running in the background to do the get async. Well, what's going on is we're now using two threads when we only should be using one. And so if you have an API that gets hundreds, thousands of requests per second, per minute, and every time a API request comes in, if you're using dot result, well, then you're essentially going to be using twice as many threads as you need, and you'll eventually hit what's called thread pool exhaustion, because .NET does have a finite number of threads, so eventually you'll run out and you'll start seeing problems. Now, maybe you have an API that doesn't get hit more than once every hour. Is dot result going to break your system? No. you're going to be using two threads when you only need to be using one, but you don't have a UI to worry about. So the user doesn't know that, we'll say the UI is frozen because there is no UI. And so, is it really that bad? No. But I would still argue to use await instead of dot result, essentially for the next developer, or if maybe the code's open source, somebody implements your library, well, they might have an API that gets called a million times a minute, and next thing you know, your library is the one breaking them, or maybe that new junior developer that just joined your team has now taken over your code base, and you're at your new company now, and so they can't ask you for help. And all of a sudden things start acting weird and the server starts to slow down. Well, that could be because of thread pool exhaustion because we're using dot result. So coming back to the original question, what do we do if we cannot use async await? Well, one option is dot result. It's bad because it's blocking. It's bad because it's going to use two threads. We only need one. But there's actually another reason why it's bad. And that is because if the code you're waiting on, so if the code that we said dot result, in this case the get async code, if that code throws an exception, remember how we said move next, or the compiler generated code for our async method gets wrapped up in a try catch block, and we said no worries because as long as you await that method, the exception will be rethrown. Well, the same is true for dot result. If you call dot result on that method, the exception will also be rethrown, but there's a caveat because the exception that is thrown isn't our exception. It's not say a null reference exception that happened in the code we wrote. Dot result, and the same is true with dot wait, will throw what's called a aggregate exception. So it's in the system library. So system.aggregate exception. And an aggregate exception is an exception that holds exceptions. So I call it an exception inception, where your exception, your null reference exception, is in there. It's inside of an inner exception, inside of aggregate exception. But with dot result and dot wait, you'll get this aggregate exception rethrown if exception happens, and then you have to go digging for your code with your stack trace. And so, long story short, if you cannot use async await, like we said earlier, if we're implementing a method or implementing an interface method that doesn't return task, and we just can't use async await, which is a total bummer. What we can do instead of calling dot wait or instead of calling dot result is we can use two methods, so it's dot get awaiter, dot get result. And get awaiter, get result actually replaces, it does the functionality of both dot wait and dot result. it's still blocking, so we still want to avoid it if we can. But the benefit from get await or get result over dot result over dot wait is that if an exception happens, it'll actually rethrow our exception. So when that null reference exception happens inside of the method, get await or get result will actually rethrow the null reference exception instead of a system.aggregate exception, then force us to go digging inside of that exception for our exception.
With the get await or get result, is there one thread in this case, or do you have two threads like we were talking about earlier?
Yeah, get await or get result will still use two threads. It'll still block the calling thread. So in that scenario, it'll still say thread one, you stay right here. I'm going to run this code on a background thread, but until I'm done, thread one, you can't go anywhere. So it's still not great.
So you're still locked in a UI, a mobile app. You still have a frozen screen?
Yep. My screen would be frozen until that API call is done. So we still want to avoid it if we can use async await. But if we have to write synchronous code, then get await or get results your best way forward.
What about back in the good old days? I remember using background workers, and I was able to, you know, keep my UI working and do this background stuff.
So as far as I know, all that stuff's still there in .NET. But basically, I won't say it's not recommended, because if you've used it before and you understand it and you have that deep, intimate knowledge of it, great. But that's essentially what async await is abstracting away, so that we don't have to worry about keeping track of those background workers, worry about what comes back when they're done, making sure our code doesn't stop executing before they're done, handling those exceptions. Async await essentially took all that goodness that we already had in .NET and, I was going to say, made it easy to use, but also kind of made it too easy to use, to where we can make some, it's easy to make mistakes with async await, because yeah, now it's just async keyword, await keyword, and I'm done.
That's the end for part one of this chat with Brandon. In part two, we talk about not returning awaits, configure await faults, value task, and a few other async await topics. The opening music was The Return by Nisi 23 from the album 11 and 12, and the closing music was The Boss by Dan Yan Key from the album Fast Swing Reloaded.